By David White. Those who will not slip beneath the still surface on the well of grief, turning downward through its black water to the place we cannot breathe, will never know the source from which we drink, the secret water cold and clear, nor find in the darkness glimmering the small round coins thrown by those who wished for something else. Welcome, everyone, to the continuation of the series on the distortions of mind. And tonight's talk is on the grieving mind. And we'll have a couple more talks after this talk, I think, to sort of round out the series and also to round out the year. But this talk is particularly I think an important talk. Not only do I feel like I know a lot about it, not only personally, but having worked in hospice programs professionally and have been connected and interfaced with so much grief. But just to start to talk out with a story, I once did a workshop. It was actually a week-long retreat that I was assisting Jack Kornfield in, on it was a holotropic breath work. Stan Grof has you breathe very deeply, very rapidly for a long period of time with music sort of blaring, and it sends you into altered states. It's sort of the legal way you get the drugs effect these days. Anyway, so I wanted to do it, just see what it was like. It was about maybe 15 years ago or 15 years ago or so. And I engaged in the workshop as well as was teaching the meditation component of it. And it worked very effectively. I mean, my mind went into kind of an altered state. But the state that it went into was grief. And the prompters are all around to help people through difficult states of mind. And if you're in that state and the prompter comes up to you and thinks that you need assistance, you can say stop, and they'll back away. So I started falling into this cavern of grief. In fact, it started out gray and ended up completely black is the color of it. Almost like I was sucked into kind of a vortex of like a black hole in which there was nothing but grief. And started sobbing uncontrollably because of it. And one of the prompters came up to me and felt that I was in some kind of trouble, and I said, stop. To her, because I really wanted to explore it. I thought it was extraordinary to see what I had been working with in hospice care and to see the depth of what grief was like, and also feeling completely safe within it, in this cavern of it. I didn't. There was an interest in it that made it a kind of a completely impersonal experience. I felt like I was experiencing the 100% purity, you know, just a single note of the whole symphony of life. This was a single note of it, and I was exploring that note in its pure form. And I also understood, I think, what got me personally involved in hospice was because of the compelling nature of grief in my own life. So it's a subject that I have a lot of appreciation for, but I don't want to romanticize it tonight. I'm not going to offer the general hospice philosophy of softening and also the accompanying meditative response of how to work so much with the difficult emotion, but rather to look at how this emotion configures, or how our minds configure reality in a certain way in which, and when they do, that inevitably, this emotion is the outcome of the way we configure reality. So I'm looking more at how the mind holds or takes a particular stance in reality, in which the outcome has to be grief. And we set ourselves up to grieve, in other words. We don't know what we're doing or why we're doing it. So I want to explore that aspect of grief tonight, because grief teaches, essentially, its greatest lesson, and the greatest lesson that any Dharma teaching can communicate. It teaches that nothing is absolutely true. Do you understand that? You see, if the response of grief, the inevitability of grief, is that everything is taken away, that death inevitably has to come, and therefore our response to that is grief, then grief shows us through its response that whatever we counted on in our life to be true isn't. True meaning predictable, consistent, secure, reliable, dependable. I mean, that's what we count life to be, isn't it? And because we count life to be that, and because it can never be that, that's the reason we grieve. And so when we explore grief, we're really exploring the fabric of our mistake, our mistaken perception of life. And that is really where I want to go tonight. I want us to look at this, because this is not a small thing. The reason that grief is one of the hardest emotions for any of us to endure is because it challenges our basic assumptions about life and about everything that we have laid upon life's plate, that we have assumed life to be. And so when it is taken away, the whole house of straw is taken away with it, if we understand. Now, is that a bad thing? It's not a good or bad thing. It's just that our mind keeps building upon life something that it can never possibly be. And so when whatever it is that we've built upon made an impossible construction upon life that it cannot possibly be, then inevitably that structure is going to fall back into reality. And that fall, that collapse, is called grief. And may I say that there's no way to wiggle out of grief. As long as there is a belief in personhood, in your sense of self, in the sense of me, there will be a grieving me. See, I like that because nobody gets out of it. You can't find your way around life so that you won't be slammed by this emotion. And but we just think that we didn't live in the right manner, or we excuse ourselves from having to suffer God's wrath in this particular situation called grief. But it has nothing to do with that. It has to do with how we hold life and the expectation and the way we assert our expectation and our anticipation upon something that cannot possibly be sustained, cannot possibly sustain it. In the Buddha, I'd just like to read something the Buddha said. He said, "Long have you suffered the deaths of fathers and mothers and sons and daughters, brothers and sisters. And while you have thus suffered, you have shed more tears upon this long way than there is water in the four great oceans. And thus have you long undergone suffering and filled the graveyards full." Now, you say, well, he's exaggerating, right? I don't think the Buddha exaggerates. I don't think he was given to that kind of hyperbole. I think he was just saying what he sees. We have cried more tears on the four great oceans, more tears than the water contained in the four great oceans. At one point I was living in Plymouth, Massachusetts, in a hospice program just north of Plymouth. And my wife and I were walking through the graveyards, some of the oldest graveyards in this country. And we enjoyed doing that because although many of the gravestones were washed out and you couldn't tell the dates or the person who was buried in the grave, some of them were not. And you could find 17th century gravestones. And you could feel, you know, some of them were just, many of them were children of just a few months old or perhaps died at birth. And you can imagine in the 17th century that life expectancy was not very long. And you're just walking through these row after row of gravestones. And what struck me very distinctly was that the grief associated with each one of these deaths, going back 400 years, and just feeling the longitudinal, the time element of grief, how long it has been a part of our of our life, in whatever short or long time we live, we can't escape it. So grief, first, just a few things about grief. Grief is not a state of mind. It is a verb. It is a process. And it contains many different emotional components within it. We think of grief as just being the sadness or the sense of loss within us, but that's not it at all. It has a wide spectrum, a wide continuum of many nuanced emotions like anger, like fear, loneliness, and etc. And so many people isolate grief out in too small of a channel and think that the other qualities, the other flavors of grief are not a component part of that experience. They are. In fact, one could say that all anger is associated with grief. Because if you look at it, you see, anger is something that you want that has been blocked, that has been thwarted, and therefore has a component of loss associated with it. Now, grief, we think grief is just natural. It's just something that, you know, is a natural part of life. But it's not a natural part of an authentic life. It's a natural part of the trance of thought. When we are lost within the trance of thought, which most of us are for the duration of our life, then grief is an inevitable response of being lost in thought, in the world. But it is not a component of the experience of life when it's not lived at the expense of thought. And at this point, I'd just like to make a distinction between loss and grief. It's a little bit like the distinction I made a few weeks ago about regret and shame. The mind has a component of just feeling loss. It's something was there and something's not. You feel the absence of something not being there anymore. And that is a natural process of life and a natural authentic response to the presence and absence of something. But grief is the proliferation out from that sense of loss, much like shame is from remorse, in which we embody our own storyline within it. And we get lost in the, because so much of us is at stake within, if it's a significant loss, if it's the loss of a child or a longtime spouse or even an endearing pet. So much, we've invested so much in the object that in the absence of that object, we lose the investment. It's like the stock market crashes. And so what is it that we invest? We invest our life's meaning, our life's purpose. We invest our sense of worth often, especially in spousal relationships or children. And so there's so much that we turn over, become dependent upon in terms of relying on other people for our sense of meaning, that the continuity or having them continuous becomes more than just the sense of us caring about them. It becomes our whole sense of a view of life. What's life worth? And I can remember so many incidences in my hospice training where long-standing relationships, when you get out there 40 years plus, the spouse who's dying, who's living, doesn't know life without the spouse who's dying. It's just been too many years. And so when that significant spouse is dying, their whole relationship to life is jeopardized because they don't have the skills to continue on as they have been without that other person. It's as if they're walking into a kind of an insecurity that they have no skill to navigate through. And that, so it's more than just the loss of a loved one, of a significant loved one. It's the loss of a sense of relationship to life, of a sense of life of being full, in fulfillment, and the expectation that we have of our ability to stabilize ourselves within life is counted on through this other person. It's interesting also in terms of grief to see it as a bittersweet emotion. In fact, grief work is often called memory work because you have to work through the memories of the loss in order to find your foot in reality once more. Now, that's a very interesting thing because memories are often the source of the pain of the grief. When you bring back or you remember something that you and your spouse did, and I'll just use the example of spouse, there's this deep sense of missing that comes. But it's also bittersweet in the sense that we perpetuate those memories in order to continue the connection with that person. So the pain is somewhat self-generated. We don't want the pain of the grief, but it's the only thing we have left that can connect us to that aspect of life that was so meaningful to us. And so we intentionally bring forth those memories in order to feel the grief, even though the grief burns with such significant pain that many people can be close to a breaking point because of it. But it's interesting to see how it can be self-generated. Now, all of us carry a repository of grief within us. None of us are free of grief. And in meditation, when we begin to soften, when the meditation is actually working, when we start letting go of some of our defenses, when we start letting life in and stop thinking so much about it, the heart will soften. And how it softens is that it's been held in check, contained, often by two significant emotions. One is fear. So sometimes there's a lot of fear when the heart softens. The other is grief. And almost routinely, people will find their movement on their spiritual journey being accompanied by this deep sense of grief all along the way. Now, that grief comes from two things. It comes from having defended ourselves from the pain of past loss. That's one. The other thing it is that when we see how we have treated ourselves, which is often what insight does. Insight shows you the patterns you've lived with that are senseless and needless. Up until that point, we felt that those patterns were needed, but insight shows a pattern. I think, how could I have done this to myself? And this enormous sense of grief accompanies that experience. So grief is often a component of spiritual growth. And not a small component either, a significant one. So when we realize that to lose our memory in grief is to lose our hope and our meaning, since so much of our memory is associated with the hope of a life lived with this other person, we'll keep bringing those memories up in order to perpetuate that sense of hope and meaning in our life. And so we'll work the memory, because at least that person represents a life well lived at some point with him or her. We had a great life together. We spent so many years, And the feeling that many of us have is that we are nothing without a sense of meaning. And so we can ennoble ourselves through what we have been rather than what we are present through our grief. You are the reason that I have lived. So many times I heard hospice caregivers say that to their loved ones. Now, when we're in meditation and we're sitting, one of the early insights that come to people and deepen over time is that all experience has a duration. Every experience, by its very definition, no matter what that experience is, has a lifespan. It comes, it stays for a while, changes while it's there, it's never unalterable, and then leaves. And so there is a way in which, as we meditate and as we grow more and more accustomed to being able to feel these experiences fully and releasing life to be able to move on its own, that we learn a significant lesson about how to work with grief, how to work with our experiences of life. And may I say that all life is an experience. All life. How we can work with that and not try to retard or slow down that duration, which is what grief tries to do. Because we take a stand in most of our trance, thought trance, the thought takes a stance that it wants to hold life steady and secure and in perpetual stability, perpetual continuity. That's when we look out upon our life and we just see how we normally relate to life, it's not with the understanding that all experiences come and go with their own duration and their own time. It's trying to manipulate and exchange and hold on to experience so that we can foster and endure that experience longer than its natural lifespan. And that is the source of grief. That is the source of grief. That is the source of all suffering. And all suffering, all loss, has a sense of grief associated with it. I was once at a public lecture by Krishnamurti, and he said, he looked up and he said, do you want to know what it's like to die? And of course, he was talking to the right audience. And everybody's ears picked up and nodded their head. And he said, think of the thing you love the most and drop it. That's death. Think of the thing you love the most and drop it. You see? And we begin to see that every time we fix something, every time we hold on to something, every time we refuse to let it go, every time we refuse to drop it, we suffer the implications of not dying fully. For grief is really about not dying. It's about not relinquishing, not releasing the hold that an experience only, has upon us. Remember that all life is an experience. There are no forms or substances. The mind creates the dimensionality of an experience. The mind creates the three dimensions. The mind creates the embodiment of a personness. What is actually being received is experience, sight, sound, smells, tastes, and thought. And we can't allow that to take on that form. We can't allow life to be as ephemeral and as insignificant as that seems to implicate. We have to make it more than it is. We have to fill it up like a balloon that has a constant hole in it. We have to keep blowing it and blowing it to keep the air, so that to keep the balloon inflated until its natural ending occurs. And some experiences last longer than others. Some last 70 years or more. Some in only a few months. And it's that deflating process. Because with it, you see, we are deflated. Because who's blowing it up? Who's the person that's grieving? What is grieving? What is grieving? Instead of looking at grief, let us look at what is it that grieves. You'll see why you grieve when you look at what is it that grieves. And that's all you'll see. Because we count so much on life being more than it'll ever or ever can possibly hold. We invest so much in our blowing it up. Because then at the end of however many decades we live, we can sit back and say, oh, well deserved. And that seems to be the summation that we're all looking for. You know, I was watching a film, one of these documentaries on elephants. It's a beautiful film, just beautiful film. But these elephants, they were following this herd of elephants. And these elephants at one point came across the bones of an elephant that had been in their herd that had died. And it was just the bones. And the herd stopped and with their trunk reached down and felt the bones, picking up the bones. You could feel that they were re-experiencing one of their own through the bones. And they delayed for a while as they took in that experience. And then they laid the bones down and they walked on. They moved on. We just don't lay the bones down, do we? We carry them with us. We put them in mausoleums or bury them in the earth, protected by several $1,000 caskets. We invest so much. In continuity. It's that need to fix and locate. Everything we fix. See, when we fix something, we rob it of movement. We set it in place. We put it on the mantle of our mind. And then, the next time we meet, we relate to it through the previous experience. Even though there may have been a number of years that have intervened between that first last fixation and the next meeting. This last weekend, what day is today? Tuesday. So it would have been Sunday? Something like that. I was with my brother in San Jose, California, who I hadn't seen for 14 years. And I don't think I would have recognized him if he hadn't recognized me. And it was just adjusting to the physical change, because my mind had not allowed that change to occur. My mind had only held the memory of who he was. And he actually surprised me in many, many different ways. He's a good person and a good-hearted person. And I saw my previous judgments about him not being able to sustain themselves. And there hasn't been a bad relationship between us. We just have been in different parts of the country and our paths just haven't crossed. But I just saw, okay, you know, see this, it can go both ways. You don't allow the person to move with you. You don't allow yourself to move, to allow the experience to move on. We want continuity above all else. Because continuity is what the self thrives on. It's what you and I thrive on. It's what you and I count on. We don't allow ourselves to move on, our own image to move on, do we? We stand in front of the mirror and we don't see the wrinkles. We see ourselves as 30-year-olds. Right? Isn't that interesting? And grief is because we don't move on. It's because we don't allow ourselves to move on. We don't allow reality. We want life, reality, to live according to our expectations of continuity. But it doesn't. So the gap between our expectation and reality is grief. And as our expectations inevitably have to come down and touch reality again, that's the bereavement process. The expectation of wanting that person we so loved and so counted on to come down tomorrow morning as he or she has for 50 years and sit with us and have our morning coffee. That memory, we won't allow it to move on. But it has to die. It has to die because after X number of days and months and perhaps years, that person doesn't come down anymore. And the pain of the anticipation never being fulfilled eventually implodes on itself, and we have to live in reality, as reality, rather than according to our expectations. And that is what grieving is about. And we are loath to do that. And we do it, it's not just when we have a significant loss, we do it all the time. You see, when you look out through your eyes, I'm sure you don't feel the age that you are physiologically or chronologically. You think of yourself, you know, as a 20-year-old, don't you? And then all of a sudden it's just not there anymore. We all know, you know, that when those are so out of sync that you have people wearing clothes that don't match their chronological age, right? And how that just doesn't feel right. Or an old actor with a young actress. It just doesn't feel right. But because he has been sort of the heartthrob of many generations, they stick him in the next movie and you go, huh, it just doesn't feel like Robert Redford doesn't work in this one anymore. I live for you. See, I live for you. I live for you. You see, we don't really grieve. It's interesting. I'm just kind of. We don't really grieve absence. When you're with somebody, most of the time they're not there with you, they're at work or upstairs. There are many, many more hours They are not present. They're absent. See, we don't grieve absence. That's not what we're grieving. We're grieving certainty, aren't we? But that certainty was never there. That certainty was never there. Whether they were upstairs or at work. Where did that certainty reside? Only in our minds. And then when that certainty proves itself to be impossible to maintain, then the absence is still there. But we have lost our hope. I want to show the relationship between meaning and expectation, because this is a key component. And I've done this on retreats and other talks. But I think it's an effective way to get the sense of what I'm talking about here. You see, life in the present is just what it is. There's no grief in the present. It's just what it is. It's just what it is. But because of the sense of continuity, of longevity, of one thing meaning something, then when something occurs, an experience occurs, it doesn't just mean it's for itself. It doesn't just mean what it is. It doesn't mean the experience of what it is. It means the meaning of what it means. For instance, you're sitting. You're sitting. And you're having a bad sitting. Now, what are you waiting for when that sitting is a bad sitting and you're watching your clock? What sound? And there's only one sound that means anything to you, isn't there? And that's the sound of, right? So that sound doesn't mean just the sound. Listen to it just as sound. You see, that's the present. That's now. It means more than just that. It means I'm free. I'm able to get up. I'm able to move on. I'm able to not suffer anymore. Now, experience contains that meaning. And we invest so much meaning into experience that we don't allow it to stand on its own. Every experience stands on its own as an experience. No experience actually means anything beyond itself. All experience is just and no more. To be able to hear at that level of immediacy, and then move on. But if we invest more than that into experience, then we wait for it. We anticipate. We expect. We long for. We want. We desire it. Now think of the investment we have with each other. And you can see that we really never see the person for what they are. We see our investment. And so when the person dies, our investment dies. Much beyond the significance of the actual moment. Now stands on its own. Each thing is complete. That's the message of the Dharma. And so the pain of disinvesting, whatever the word is the pain of grief. Now, there are two levels of surrender in grief. And I would just like to talk about them for a moment. The first level of surrender is to surrender to what is. When something occurs and is not, you surrender to the absence as well as the presence of an experience. You surrender to it. You just, this is it. Now it's here, now it's present, now it's not. I was with a family, a very close family, of children about middle teenagers, 15, 16, husband, wife dying. I was in the home. We were gathered around the bed as the wife was dying. The wife dies. And we were just caught in a moment when she died. There's this beautiful feeling that occurred in this room of a kind of a transcendence, a transcendent quality in this death. And it held us in the amazement, in the mystery of that passing. And for a long period of time after this woman dies, myself and the family were just alone in the grace of the nothingness, experiencing the sense of mystery, of the enraptured experience of what we had just experienced, and feeling the after effect, the afterglow of that in terms of how we looked and saw and related to life. And we were just looking around the room with that kind of afterglow of mystery from what had just occurred. That lasted maybe several minutes, maybe 10 minutes, until the story came back in. And then everybody crashed from the mystery back into the story. And then the sobbing and the tearing and the whole thing became the beginning of the bereavement component. But for a moment there, where we were allowed the passing to occur and felt that when there is a hole, when something else comes through that hole, when something leaves, that leaving, that absence, is filled with something else. See, we're too quick to move over that sense of loss because it has such a significant part to play upon what my life's meaning and purpose is, that we can't stand the objective fact of that loss because of its implication of what it means to our life, that we miss the moment of nothingness. And we fill it with grief, which continues the story of me. The nothing doesn't. The nothing doesn't allow the story to continue. But grief does. So we move away from the nothing to the sense of grief to reestablish the continuation of our theme of life. Now, the second level of grief, if we miss just accepting what is then we have to surrender to the pain of what you feel when you haven't accepted what is, and that's grief. So the second level of surrender is to the emotion of grief, and that is very difficult for most people. Because they're perpetuating the emotion through their storyline, even as they're trying to accept the emotion for just what it is as an experience. They can't accept it just as an experience because they feel disconnected in their heart from that which they have just lost without perpetuating the memory. So they keep the memory moving by playing the story, which continues the emotion. And then they're trying to accept the emotion, even as they're creating the very problem of their suffering. If there's great loss, there's great pain. And we feel that pain with our story. We don't move to the unknown. What is grief? What is this feeling? What is this thing? Free of the content. What is going on in this moment? Let me feel this. Let me feel this emotion. Let me feel this. Just what is. And then we can move into the unknown and allow that mystery once more to unfold. Wherever we catch the chain of events, if we arrest and stay still with that chain, with that link, it will take us, it will plummet us, really, into the mystery, back into the mystery. But the farther we get down that chain, the more difficult it is to unhook the storyline. Because each link is fostered and encouraged by the story. And so we lose ourselves again and again in our own writing, in our own memoir. And so grief can take long periods of time. Sometimes, well, it takes a lifetime, doesn't it? I mean, think of someone who you have lost and see if there isn't a residual feeling of pain still there. How many years later? Because we think that the only way we can still honor that person is to still feel pain for them. But if you think of that person in your heart, you'll see that the love is still there, even though the form is not. And we invested the person in the form, not in the heart. And so when the form leaves, his appearance or her appearance, their experience, me being around them, then we think they're no longer in our heart because we've missed the central theme of the whole thing all along, which was the love, which has maintained and continued. We hold on to the form because the form represents, has been our placeholder of love. It's been what we've invested our love in. And then when that form leaves, which all forms do, we think our love has lost, has left with it, because we didn't see that the love was independent. But love is the one thing that does have duration, even though the forms of life cannot maintain that. The love can. See, the heart is connection. The mind is the story of connection. When we experience life through the heart, free of the words of the trance of thought, then we live within the realm of that wonder, of that mystery, of that love. When we live within the story of that connection, which is the mental overplay, then when we lose the form, we've lost the story. And we've invested so much in the story that we even forget that our heart exists. So let us remember that images will die, that all form is only temporary. We're only here temporarily with each other. That it's all just a giant stew. But let us find something that has duration instead of investing in things that never can hold it. Let us find a stability in now, which allows experience its own time and its own movement, but doesn't invest in holding on or the continuation of that. And so we walk independent of the need for form to keep meeting our expectation. And live within the wonder and the unknown of love. That's where the spiritual journey points. And the lessons of that spiritual journey are very well contained within the process of grief. May we all understand that process. If we could just sit for a minute or two. As we're sitting here, just being quiet for a moment, where are you investing in your experience? Where are you arresting its movement, fixating, stabilizing, constructing? Where are you allowing it to move on its own? Where are we so dependent for the maintenance of form for our survival? Because that's what it really is about. For our meaning, for our purpose. We can never find the true purpose of life as long as we find it within the trance of thought. Because the true purpose of life lives within its meaninglessness or perceived meaninglessness of thought. Where you can let it be just as it is, then everything has meaning. Not for any sense of continuity, but for itself, for its own aliveness. Okay, good. So if there are any questions or comments by anybody, I'd be happy to explore. Yes. You were what?
Hugging was like my experience.
Right, right.
Like the first self. And so I flipped it into metta. And when it comes up, I just flipped it into metta toward that person.
Right.
And it really seemed like the right thing to do. And it's
really specific. Yes.
From the grasping on my side.
Right. So you're right. So that you've had a loss and there's a tugging or a pull or a grasping. And you turned it into a metta response to that person. It's interesting that What composes that tugging is not often it's not often just good experiences. In fact, some of the most difficult tuggings that occur after a death is because of the ambiguity of the relationship, of the unclarity, because we invest not just with our own good qualities that were nurtured in that relationship, but also our sense of shame or guilt or reluctance, or remorse, because of what we didn't do for that person, what we weren't for that person, how that person treated us, and all of that different, very cloudy, confused, unclear perception doesn't allow a full and complete and clean grief. So people often think when they grieve that they have to grieve just to think of the person in the best terms, and that's, you have to grieve the whole person. You have to grieve them as reality showed them to us. Those parts of them that were not appreciated, as well as those parts of him or her that were. Sometimes, really honor the fact that there is anger as a component part of the grieving process. And it's not a betrayal of the connectedness that you felt. It can help speed the memory work that's necessary for the completion of that grief. We grieve the whole. Other questions or comments? Okay.